Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, Madrid is over. Rome is already underway. And what a Madrid it was on my TV. I want to know what it was like in reality if you were courtside. Catherine Whittaker was exactly that. Catherine, hello.
Hello, David.
Tell me and Matt what it was like to be inside the big metal box, also known as the magic box.
Well, the metal box element of the Madrid Open is definitely the least appealing aspect of it. I mean, there's no getting around it. The venue is shocking, visually, aesthetically. I don't know what, I know we've probably talked about this. I mean, we're coming up to our 10-year anniversary, aren't we? We've probably said this annually for 10 years now. When did the Caja Magica come into beautiful existence? 2012? Anyway, it's hideous. And from a TV perspective, it's very, very difficult to find places to film that look visually pleasing or even neutral. You know, the default is visually displeasing. I can see what they were aiming for. You know, uber modern, edgy, you know, very architectural, but I don't know. It didn't work out. But the center court, when it's rocking and it's full, is special. It creates a very, very electric, pulsating atmosphere. It's a very unforgiving center court. If it's empty, it feels hollow and echoey and even emptier than it actually is. I think it's very cold. I mean, it's metal. But standing courtside during some of the pulsating matches that we had over the course of the last week is something I'm going to remember forever. I think it was extremely special, and the whole week actually exceeded my expectations. I've been to that tournament twice before and enjoyed it both times for a number of different reasons. One year I saw Andy Murray win here. He beat Rafael Nadal in the final. That was very special, but I didn't warm to it as a venue. I didn't feel like I had many experiences of it at its peak potential, and I do this week feel like I experienced that, and it was extremely special.
Matt, you had a similar one, I think, the first time the Davis Cup finals were held there, didn't you, when Nadal was roaring and it was all going off. So it's just me who's had the rubbish experiences.
Yes, that's right. Although I would raise Catherine's cold in May and give you my Magic Box in November. That is my overwhelming memory of the Magic Box. It is freezing because the majority of the venue is outdoors. It's only actually the actual stadiums, the seats in the stadiums, which are indoors. All the walking around is quite exposed. And yeah, very, very cold in November. But as you said, when Nadal's playing, pulsating.
It's a very COVID-friendly venue, isn't it? It's one of those, like all the temporary structures that have sprung up during the course of, you know, various lockdown, sort of how to be outdoors when really you're indoors. The Kaya Magica achieved that way ahead of its time.
Yes, indeed. Well, we're going to warm you up with lots of chat about Carlos Alcaraz as an entrepreneur who were setting the place alight, really, atmospherically, over the last 10 days or so. We'll also warm you up, dear listener, with some news of our Wilson competition for Roland Garros tickets on the 27th of May. Because if you become a friend of the Tennis Podcast, you can enter our exclusive competition. We will send you the link to enter our competition. Two tickets to Roland Garros. All you got to do is become a friend. If you are one already and you haven't been able to get our newsletter for whatever reason, just let us know. Send us an email to friends@tennispodcast.net and we'll sort you out with that link. And we are going to be in Roland Garros as well in a couple of weeks' time, because the Tennis Podcast is going to the French Open for the first time ever. And we're getting a Tennis Podcast Towers in Paris, Catherine.
Le Tour Podcast.
Yeah, that. Right then, Madrid. Let's talk first of all about Carlos Alcaraz, shall we? Because this guy has managed to beat Rafael Nadal, Novak Djokovic and Alexander Zverev in 3 days to win the title. I mean, that doesn't do it justice just saying that, does it? I mean, we saw it on the telly. I've asked you about it, what it's like in the Magic Box, Catherine. I'm very curious to know how the Carlos Alcaraz experience in person compares to others that you've had courtside in the course of your career. I mean, you've been at a lot of big moments, really, over the course of time. And I mean, I always think, well, what does the drop shot sound like with the crowd intake of breath and all that sort of thing? But just generally, what sort of buzz does he create versus some of the others that you can think of?
Oh, crikey. I mean, let's stick a big recency bias warning on this podcast right now, shall we? Because just at this moment, and I'm in the immediate aftermath of it all, and I was standing a few meters away from it, and you probably know that because I'm very aware that our presentation position for Prime Video was right in the back of the shot the whole time. We didn't ask to be there. There was nowhere else for us to stand or sit and watch the match. We had no choice but to video bomb pretty much 100% of all the centre court action. So yes, I am very conscious that I'm about to say something that is guilty of extreme recency bias, but I also don't know how to eliminate it from how I'm thinking and how I'm feeling right now. So let's just stick the warning on and proceed as we were. It's incomparable. Really, in terms of the tennis, I'm not sure I've seen anything like it, quite frankly. He's quicker, he's stronger, he's more powerful, he's got lighter touch. Not than anyone has ever had any one of those individual things, although possibly a couple of them. I'm not sure I've ever seen a ball be hit that hard consistently. Maybe, you know, the odd thundercrack forehand from Juan Martín Del Potro, the odd shot here and there, but his baseline weight of shot, I've never seen anything like it. I've never seen that combination with touch and feel before. And we had Martina Navratilova involved in our coverage on Prime Video over the weekend, and she was particularly taken by the fact that his feel doesn't seem to wane when it gets tight. She said, usually when you get tight and everybody gets tight, the feel is the first thing to go. And she was waiting for it to happen, and it just never did. Now, whether that's the beauty of youth, you know, he does seem utterly fearless, and he is only 19 years old, but it also seems to be something quite special about Carlos Alcaraz. And she also pointed out that, yes, the drop shot is utterly dreamy, but what actually makes it so potent is the fact that it is combined with such brute power, because opponents have no choice but to respect that power and back off the ball, which just makes you his drop shot prey, doesn't it? He's got you right where he wants you. And yet, as much as I'm sure all the players know that they're falling into his trap, I'm not sure what you do. Because his ball is so big that I'm not sure you can just say, oh, well, I'm going to stand up on the baseline and take it early and half volley it. I'm just not sure that's possible. It wasn't even possible for Novak Djokovic. And maybe somebody will crack the code and create a formula for beating him, as is often the case when young players break through and they bring something new and they shock the tour. Someone cracks the code and the template is created for others to follow. Maybe that'll happen, but I can't only not see what that template is. I can't conceive of what it might be. There's just no chinks, let alone holes. And none of the pundits that know better than me on a technical level have been able to conceive of what that formula might be either. Mm. So it is an intoxicating combination of skills. And that's not even to mention the poise and the way he deals with the just mounting immense pressure on his shoulders and the emotional hurricane that it must be to beat Rafael Nadal the day after your 19th birthday and then to come back and beat Djokovic the next day, and then for that not even to be the summit of the mountain. Goodness me, we've got something on our hands in Carlos Alcaraz.
Oh yeah. This drop shot, by the way, you add in the disguise. I don't know when it's coming. And you can tell that players don't know when it's coming, because once he's hit two or three of them, you can see them thinking, oh, it's coming. And they make a few, like a half a step forward, and then realize, no, he's blasted me into smithereens at the back of the court. So what do you do? Matt, I was doing parenting duties on Saturday. So I was sort of trying to watch the Djokovic match on my phone silently whilst I was supposed to be overseeing some 10-pin bowling. This run of matches, he's beaten Nadal in three sets despite turning his ankle halfway through. And I think that's a pretty monumental mental achievement to not panic and just completely capitulate at that point. I mean, he lost that second set 6-1, didn't he? And then he's come back and he's outlasted Novak Djokovic from a set down in 3 hours, 40-odd minutes. And then he's gone and drubbed Alexander Zverev the following day. Which of them impressed you the most and why?
Well, I think what makes this title run so extraordinary is the package, isn't it? It's the one after the other. So they're all impressive in their own right. And together they're even more impressive. But hands down for me, the one that stands out is the win over Djokovic. Alexander Zverev didn't really show up in the final. And Alcaraz was toying with him and he just put him away inside an hour. He just frankly showed himself to be a better, more complete tennis player, really, even in conditions which I think favour Zverev. The Nadal match was a bit weird with the injury and there was a big interruption in the crowd as well. It just had a bit of a weird rhythm to it, that match. I found it quite difficult to gauge. But I do think we cannot downplay what Alcaraz did there, beating Nadal in Madrid, his hero, his icon, doing that for the first time. That's a big, big moment for Alcaraz. And the way he finished that match off, I think, really sort of demonstrated everything that he's about. So that was impressive. But I just thought he took it up another level with the win over Djokovic for many reasons, really. You know, we've mentioned the drop shot already. That obviously stood out. The way that complements his power blows my mind. The fact that he can do it off his forehand and his backhand as well, I think, is kind of another weapon. Or on a volley. He can do a nice touch drop volley. I discovered that he's got this amazing kick serve in that match against Djokovic. And I'm sure he was slightly aided by the altitude and the conditions. And it remains to be seen whether he can do that at sea level quite so effectively. But Novak Djokovic is the best returner I've ever seen, and he was really struggling to get that Alcaraz kick serve back in the court, frankly. I mean, Alcaraz was using that for cheap points.
He puts you in the flower pots, doesn't he, out on the side of the court, is his goal with that kick serve.
Yeah, he does. He literally does. And he occasionally uses it to set up the point. So he can use it in lots of different ways. And that, I thought, was amazing. There's also just the mentality that he displayed, I thought, was incredible. A lot of it was resilience, because there were a lot of moments there where I felt like maybe he might let it slip because he had a chance, couldn't quite convert it. Djokovic saved it, you know, showed us who he is. And so often he goes on to win the match from that position, Novak Djokovic. But Alcaraz just created another opportunity and took that opportunity. So I found that resilience mentally pretty amazing. He also did it for, you know, 3 hours against Novak Djokovic. He sustained a level that was really high. You know, sometimes players do it for a set. Sometimes they might do it for two sets. You know, he did it for three sets, really. Out hitting Djokovic, I think, double the number of winners, which was just amazing. And this was Djokovic playing well. You know, this was, I would say Nadal was a sort of 6 or 7 out of 10, but I felt like Djokovic was playing well. And he would sometimes deploy his very best shots, Djokovic, you know, his backhand down the line he would hit, and you'd think, okay, fine, Djokovic has got him now, he's found the backhand down the line, does Alcaraz have an answer to that? And he did. Like, the very next point, Djokovic tried it again, and Alcaraz turned the tables on him, hit a winner up the line with his forehand, and he was just doing things that you haven't really seen players do before to Djokovic. And he was also embracing the moment. He's just appeared to be loving it, smiling, jumping up and down, fist pumping. And so many players are good tennis players, but great tennis players have a different sort of quality about them, which is really hard to define. And Alcaraz seems to have that. He plays his best tennis in the big moments, which is what Djokovic has done, Federer's done, Nadal's done over the years. Alcaraz is doing that to these players. That I've not really seen before from a young player. And I'm such a big believer in the pack hunter theory, that beating one of these players is hard but possible. Beating them back to back over consecutive days on clay had literally never been done before. He was the first player ever to do that. And you know, if we take 2011 onwards, Djokovic, which is kind of when he became the great player that he is, nobody's done it back to back on any surface. So, you know, quite literally, he's doing things which no one's done before. And I'm sure people will point to the fact that this wasn't peak Nadal, this wasn't peak Djokovic. But I'm sure it hasn't been peak Nadal and peak Djokovic in the past for other players, and they've not been able to do it. There was still reigning Grand Slam champions. Djokovic is the world number one. They're still pretty much at the top of their game. And Alcaraz beat them on back-to-back days, age 19. I think we're right to be just getting hyped about this. Yeah, 2 days into his 20th year.
he got a nicer cake than he got last year, didn't he? Last year, he got a bruising defeat and a sort of slightly pooey-looking cake. This year, a brilliant victory. Who was the win on his birthday? Was it Cameron Norrie?
Yes.
It was Cameron Norrie. Norrie pushed him fairly close, actually, although it did always feel like Alcaraz was going to win. But it was all about the cake, really, wasn't it? And, of course, we'd been tipped off that presentation ceremony was planned regardless of outcome. But it was a handsome enough cake that I think it would have looked silly handing it to
maybe they got like a one if you lost, you know, sort of like a bit of a damp.
It's an interesting benchmark, though, isn't it? Because last year they went ahead with the cake ceremony on his 18th birthday, even though he'd just been hammered by Nadal, and that didn't feel awkward. That felt like a really nice moment, because it was still a special occasion, just seeing him play Nadal, and the fact that it was, you know, a one-sided beatdown wasn't surprising, or, you know, it wasn't something that would necessarily have left Alcaraz crushed and in a state of not wanting to receive public cake. But this year, I think it would have been deeply weird and awkward had they gone ahead with cake in the event of defeat. But I think they were just probably that confident that he was going to win that they put the turbochargers on the cake makers
and brought out sparklers with the cake and actually it's a perfect illustration, that, isn't it, of Alcaraz's progression. Last year he was happy enough to receive a cake off the back of a trouncing against Nadal. This year he's beaten Nadal. Like, not many players can make that jump in a year, I don't think.
And still gets cake.
And that's serving
had
out.
Had his cake and ate it.
Serving out to beat Nadal with his full repertoire. A drop shot winner, a serve and volley, showing that he's got touch and nous and understanding of a way to win a point under pressure. And then to finish it with a swerving forehand around Nadal in the sort of manner that Nadal's been doing to everybody else on the planet for the last 15 years. Just felt perfect, really, in that regard. And then Alcaraz, well, as I thought he might, withdrew immediately from Rome and just dealt the ultimate power play, as if to say, there you are, lads. I've beaten you all to a pulp. Enjoy yourselves in Rome. I'll see you in Paris. And I'm really interested now, because it's not just his power play, because now we're going to get Djokovic and Nadal and the other best players in the world studying this guy, and they're going to get their coaches on the job, and they're probably going to talk amongst themselves, and Djokovic is going to go back and watch videos of himself beating goodness knows who from the last 15 years. And Nadal can dip into his reservoir of memory of 13 Roland Garros titles just to remind themselves how great they truly are. So what happens when it all comes together is so fascinating, isn't it? When we get to Roland Garros and you've got this young kid who has just been beating everybody, but we've got these guys who have been there, done it, and have nothing to prove, and have still got stuff left in the tank. I mean, it's very interesting looking at the... And we don't accept betting sponsorship here on the Tennis Podcast. It's something we're very, very adamant about. But I was curious to have a little look about the betting odds, just to see what the bookies made of it all right now after Madrid. And they've got Alcaraz second favourite for Roland Garros, a whisker behind Nadal and ahead of the defending champion, Novak Djokovic. I do think that is maybe an overreaction, personally, in terms of, I think Djokovic, he played pretty well in that match, and he was only just beaten by Alcaraz. So I think he would probably be a bit miffed about that if somebody told him. Don't you? That he's third favourite?
I definitely think he would be miffed. Whether it's right or wrong is really fascinating. I think if you asked around every tennis expert, pundit, ex-player you like, I'm not sure you'd find any picking Djokovic ahead of Alcaraz at the moment. That doesn't mean Djokovic doesn't have a chance and it's not close, but I'm not sure you'd find any. I think Nadal has to be the official favourite, because he has 13 Roland Garros titles.
Are you picking
say
him?
That again. 13.
Who are you picking?
If I were an odds compiler, I would put Nadal as the favourite. But I am right now, and I reserve the right to change my mind after Rome, right now I'm picking Alcaraz.
Okay.
I do think he's going
to
win it.
Matt, how big is five sets? When we get to Roland Garros, Novak Djokovic so good at navigating five-set matches. We saw it when he's two sets to love down against Tsitsipas last year, finds a way through. When he got Musetti to retire for the fans in the two sets to love down match, he's so
good.
Did
it again this week, guys.
Yeah, he did. He manages these five-set matches. Nadal eats five-set matches for breakfast. Alcaraz has barely even seen one on telly, let alone playing
them. Hang on. Beat Tsitsipas at the US Open last year in a pretty epic...
All right.
That was a five-set.
Yeah, fifth-set tiebreak.
But still, I don't know. I mean, get him deep into these tournaments against these two over five sets of Roland Garros. That is a different situation to what we've just had, isn't it?
It's a factor. Absolutely, it's a factor. It will make a difference, and I think it does favour Nadal and Djokovic for all the reasons you've said there. I don't think Alcaraz will struggle, though, with it. You know, physically, he looks so strong. He looks ready to go 4 or 5 hours, you know, consecutive days even. He's, you know, he said, didn't he? He was asked by Martina Navratilova on the Prime coverage, and in this amazing, brilliant moment of self-awareness, he was asked, how did you not get tired? You know, how did you do this? How did you back it up? And he just said, well, I'm 19.
I really wanted to pop back at him there. Mate, I've been 19. I really feel like we've had different experiences of being 19. I know you're only 3 days in.
You think you're the only person who's ever done 19, don't you? We've all been there. We were just rubbish at it. All right? Okay.
Yeah, so physically, I'm not worried about Alcaraz. Physically, I'm more worried about Nadal. Look, Nadal is my pick for Roland Garros. I think he will always be my pick for Roland Garros just because of his record there. I'm pretty sure I've probably said he's not going to win it in the past, and he has won it, and I've felt like an idiot. You know, I don't want to say Nadal is not going to win Roland Garros, and then Nadal win Roland Garros, because that's just what he does. And he is so great at that tournament. I'm just always going to pick him. I am worried about the foot a little bit for him. You know, he mentioned it this week again. I think he's going to continue mentioning it. He's in pain with it. It is about managing that pain. And we've seen him overcome the pain this year in Australia. So that gives me great belief. But we've also kind of seen him succumb to that pain before last year, for example, even in the fourth set against Novak Djokovic of that amazing match they played at Roland Garros. He was hobbling. So it's possible that could happen again. But I just think while Alcaraz rests in this Rome week, it's possible that Nadal gets what he needs to be as close to 100% as he can be for Roland Garros. And that is a different force to what Alcaraz felt in Madrid. You know, Nadal does not love those conditions. He actually said that in an ideal world, he would have come back in Estoril, this comeback, because he wanted to play at sea level. But he wasn't ready in time, so it had to be Madrid. And Nadal on clay is really aggressive when he's at his best. He's dominating points. He's smothering opponents. He wasn't doing that at all to Alcaraz. He was reacting. And that might be because Alcaraz is so good that Nadal can't do it. But I still think Nadal can go up some levels. And if he does go up those levels, that's a different prospect for Alcaraz. And as good as Alcaraz is at the net and at finishing points in different ways, that's where I think Nadal has really developed his game as well. He can win points in different ways and finish points at the net. So honestly, get me to Paris. I am so excited about how the Nadal, Djokovic, Alcaraz trio plays out. It's as tantalizing a prospect going into a slam as I can remember, really. I think it's fascinating.
Matt, I don't want to make you combust, but I think it is entirely possible that they could all three be in the same half of the draw.
Oh, wow, yes, I think you're right. Do I want that?
Yeah, I don't.
I want the matches to happen.
yeah.
But I want them at the end of the tournament. Maybe they could just play their own French Open.
Can you imagine the relief on the faces of the next gen if Alcaraz, Nadal and Djokovic are left to tear one another apart in one side of the draw and they get to pootle through in the other? They do all look like they've seen a ghost, don't they?
Oh, yeah. They were not banking on this when they thought they had timed their ascent to the top of tennis to just, you know,
they
come
were looking,
after
they
the
were
big
looking
three.
Back at Dimitrov and Raonic going, ha.
Yeah. Nishikori's laughing now.
Timing is everything, guys.
And I'm going to have a window of that lot.
Yeah, I'm not saying that Tsitsipas, Medvedev, suppose Zverev are not going to win any slams, and Medvedev's already won one. You know, Alcaraz is not going to win every slam. no, from now until the end of his career, even if he continues playing this level forever, you know, it just doesn't work like that. It's not possible. So I'm sure they will. But he has changed. Alcaraz is changing the course of the future that they all envisioned post Big Three era, for sure. For sure. And I think the rug is pulled out from under them all, rather. And it'd be interesting to see how much they can improve to catch up, quite frankly. Tsitsipas, I don't think, is far off on clay. I do think he's off. I would back Alcaraz to beat Tsitsipas at the French Open, but I think he's far closer than the rest. I do think that semi-final performance against Zverev on Saturday night was bizarre from Tsitsipas, actually. It was a strange, flat, irritable performance from him.
Bet he's a different bloke at Paris, though. You know,
He is. And I do, you know, I put him a close fourth behind the three that we're talking about. I really do. I've been really reminded just how much of a beast he is on clay over the course of the past few weeks. But I still think Alcaraz changes the game for him, changes the complexion of the rest of his career. I do.
Wow. This is amazing.
I mean, the prospect of domination for any of them, I think, is gone.
Yeah, I'd agree with you there. Scheduling, Matt. Was Alexander Zverev shafted? Did that? The fact that he ended up getting on the court, I mean, he reckons, in his post-match press conference, he said nothing about this on court when he was telling everybody that Madrid's his favourite tournament on earth. But in his post-match press conference, he was asked about Carlos Alcaraz's performance, and then about his second sentence, he went off on one about how he was getting to bed at 4 a.m. and how the ATP had done a terrible job scheduling everything. Has he got a point?
Yes, he does have a point. Because, frankly, the scheduling throughout Madrid, I think, a joke, and we'll come on to it in terms of why it's more of a joke for the women. It impacts them a lot more than the men. It is a tournament structured to favour the men. It's just this one match where Zverev ended up finishing very late, and he does have a point, because I think that is unacceptable. Annoyingly, in tennis, it's accepted. You know, it is accepted that matches finish beyond midnight for some reason. It is the only sport, as far as I'm aware, that continually plays in the middle of the night for some reason. And, you know, you could make a sort of cultural case that Madrid is different to London, for example, and a lot more people will be at the matches at midnight than they would be here. And there was a decent crowd for that Zverev Tsitsipas semi-final. But it still has an impact on the players, and it's still kind of unfair to them to then have to come back the next day, especially when you've got a split session semi-final. One's finishing in the afternoon, one's finishing in the evening. The person who finishes in the evening's got way less recovery time. So I do think it's unfair, and I do think he has a point. I don't think it's the reason he lost the match, and I think he did a real 180, didn't he? He was praising the tournament as much as anyone possibly can in his post-match speech on the court, and then he just went in on the ATP in the press conference. I think it was a contributing factor, perhaps, to his performance, but I don't think it was the reason. I think Alcaraz was just better, and is better, quite frankly.
Matt referenced, Catherine, that the women have got the bigger gripe here, the fact that they were scheduled for their final sandwiched between these two semi-finals on the Saturday, when the men had their finals day all to themselves on the Sunday. A hugely different scenario. They ended up taking to the court a good couple of hours later than the sort of not before time that was given on the order of play, did Didonis Jabeur and Jessica Pegula. And they took to the court when the crowd were emotionally exhausted after cheering to the rafters for 3.5 hours for Alcaraz and Djokovic. So they left, went to the loo, had something to eat, and the final was half over before people were really coming back into their seats. I mean, just on about on every level, that is just plain rude, if nothing else, and disrespectful from the organisers to schedule the women like that. And I can't believe that more of a fuss wasn't made of this. What I mean, you know, we had Steve Simon on the podcast the other week, and it was great to hear from him, and he answered all the questions. But why is that? Why are they not going nuts about this? Why aren't they telling everybody that this is unacceptable to be treated like this?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. The fact that it happens is almost secondary to the fact that tennis just seems to shrug its shoulders about it. Same as Matt was saying with the late finishes. It's the acceptable is accepted in tennis, and it doesn't have to be like that.
As long as it's women, it's acceptable. Imagine if this was the men. Imagine if it was the... Which it never is. I cannot remember ever having a men's final sandwiched between two women's semi-finals and having to be shunted about in the order of play and all the rest of it and not have the spotlight to it. I'm not aware of it ever having happened. And I tell you what, imagine what it would be like if it did.
Well, Zverev laid into the schedule. I'm not sure it was the right direction of attack to go for the ATP on that rather than the tournament, by the way. Perhaps the ATP have a say and they lobby on behalf of their players in the schedule. But I believe the majority responsibility for the schedule goes to the tournament. So I think it just sort of conveniently suits his current agenda to be, you know, directing his ire towards the ATP, as a side note. But what happened to him and Tsitsipas on their semi-final night, which I agree with Matt, is unacceptable. I agree with Zverev, it's unacceptable. I also agree wholeheartedly that it is not why he lost that final. but it had happened to Jessica Pegula and Jill Teichmann the night before, and nobody had even barely mentioned it, or a couple of nights before, rather, because, of course, the men got the quarterfinal stage all to themselves on Friday, didn't they? The women had played their semis on the Thursday, so the men get Friday quarterfinals all to themselves. It's so depressingly predictable. And maybe that's why we're all so jaded about it and we're not up in arms more, because it's consistently happening and there's only so much energy to devote to raising one's arms. But if anybody, next time anybody even considers throwing the market forces argument out there in defence of unequal prize money or unequal scheduling or unequal anything, frankly, in tennis, you need to look at what happened on Saturday in Madrid and on countless other occasions in the tennis calendar this year and any year, and realise how truly uneven and rigged the playing field is. That was an inconsistent analogy. I was trying to find an economics version of a playing field. The forces are working in... somebody help me.
Well, no, I mean, I know exactly what you're saying. When's the men's final? It's whenever it was, 5:30 on Sunday. When's the women's final? Oh, I don't know. Because it depends on the men's match.
Yeah. There's your stage, lads. Go and enjoy it. Women, we'll fit you in when we've got the men's matches done. All right.
And for anybody saying, look, you know, it was completely exceptional. The Djokovic-Alcaraz match was completely exceptional. You know, it was a really extreme example. But a couple of things here. Number one, I mean, that match being as exceptional as it was the dream for the tournament. If you'd offered them that, they would have bitten your hand off at the start of the day. So best case scenario for the tournament, when they set that schedule, they are wanting the women's final to be delayed They are wanting it not to go on time. They are wanting those players to be put through the ringer. Goodness knows how many times they had to warm up. That is the ideal scenario for the tournament. And that suddenly feels quite sinister when you think of it like that. The starting point for the schedule should be, right, it is women's finals day. How do we make sure the women start an appointed time and get the spotlight today? And you work backwards from there. I guarantee it's possible.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. Let's talk about those women that deserve that spotlight, Ons Jabeur and Jessica Pegula, who played a three-set final. Just before we talk about that specific match, Catherine, compare and contrast for me and rate, respectively, the Ons Jabeur drop shot against the Carlos Alcaraz drop shot.
Oh, that's a horrible question. I resent it.
Is it a draw?
I do think she's got the best drop shot in women's tennis. And I really hate that you've put me in a position of saying that because I hate the, you know, using women's as a qualifier in that sentence. I do think with Alcaraz, it's the combination with the power that is so seductive. With Jabeur, it's...
She's a magician, really, with it, isn't she?
She could hit it behind her back, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
With her eyes closed.
And
for fun. Anytime.
Yeah, there's something so ethereal about it, almost ethereal about her tennis generally, the way she changes direction on the ball, and she actually has the combination with power. It's just obviously not quite as blow your socks off power as Carlos Alcaraz has. I think she is extraordinary, Ons Jabeur. I think she is not only a beautiful tennis player who must have been inspired in recent years by Ash Barty and the way that Ash Barty found a way to, as you always put it, David, package her tools to create a winning formula. She must have looked and gone, huh, I've got those tools as well. If I can just crack this and find a way to put it all together, then sky's the limit for me. And of course, the mentality is followed. I'm busy making a point. I don't wish to make any bold predictions right now, David. I would like to talk about how she's a pioneer and a trailblazer for Arab sportswomen and Arab women in general. I think the importance and significance of that cannot be underestimated. And I particularly love the way that she embraces it and leans into it. She is happy and privileged to be a representative for women and for sport in Arab nations. And that is taking an awful lot of additional pressure on her shoulders for a woman that has perhaps struggled historically in a lot of the pressure moments. She had had a really bad record in finals coming into this match, hasn't she? And to accept the mantle of playing not just for yourself, but for Tunisia and Arab nations and Arab women and Muslim women, I find incredible, really, because there's a lot of players in tennis that don't embrace something bigger when they could. And I get it. It's an incredibly demanding sport. Incredibly. It's an incredibly selfish sport. But when they do embrace standing for something bigger, Naomi Osaka, Coco Gauff, there are other examples. But when they do, it matters and it is worthy of praise. And of course, there was that moment on the podium with Jessica Pegula when they were presented with a bottle of champagne each, because the tournament has a champagne partner, as most tournaments do. And there was a really awkward moment where Ons Jabeur obviously didn't want to make things uncomfortable for anybody, but also didn't want to have her photo taken holding a bottle of champagne. And she dealt with it incredibly elegantly. And I don't want to criticise too much about the fact that uncomfortable moment happened and wasn't foreseen, because it only emphasises really the fact that this has never happened before. An Arab woman has never stood on a stage like that and had a moment like that. And hopefully the fact that that happened and Ons Jabeur is doing these things means that it won't happen again. And that's significant. I think she's incredible.
What did we see in terms of a match, in terms of a final match between these two?
Well, I think what I loved about Ons Jabeur all week is that there were these new elements to her. You know, I think particularly against Bencic and against Halep, who were players she hadn't beaten before, she sort of showed a slightly different side. She certainly against Bencic slightly simplified her game, I felt. But really, I think it was the Ons we've always known and loved, just a better version. And I think we saw that in the final, because she had the blip. You know, she had the second set where her game disappeared from her and she lost it 6-love. And you could see the exasperation and the stress. And I think she said she was breathing like a pregnant woman. You know, she was really, really panicking a bit, I think, in that final, because it had happened to her before. And she subsequently said to the WTA Insider that her heart couldn't take another disappointment. So she was in a position which she's been in before, and yet she managed to change that story for herself. You know, she'd lost 4 deciding sets in finals, and this one, there was a grit about her, and she went out and raised her game again in the third set and won it. And I kind of loved that it was recognisably still Ons Jabeur, but just a better version. And I don't think it's a coincidence that she was travelling with her psychologist with her for just, I think, the second tournament ever. And she's spoken about the difference it made having her psychologist with her in person, as opposed to just making phone calls or talking on Zoom or something like that. And I'm sure everyone can relate to that, you know, over the last 2 years, how much more impactful in-person conversations are, and just what it means to have people around you. And yeah, I think having the psychologist there to observe her during matches, during practice, just around the grounds, I think all made a difference and all helped to make this, you know, the best tournament of Ons Jabeur's life. And I think she's amazing. And when we talk about her as a pioneer and as a trailblazer, there are very big hurdles that she had to overcome, which other players from some European nations, for example, or America, for instance, just didn't have to face. You know, she has not been able to see it to be it. She's just had to be it. She's had a lot of sponsors turn her down. She's not had the financial help that some players will have had. And I went back and looked at the early part of her career. She had, I think, 11 main draw WTA wildcards, which isn't a lot. And most of those were Doha or Rabat or Marrakesh. She just didn't get that many opportunities. She had to work her way. She's done that all throughout her career. She's just incrementally improved kind of season upon season. And we are where we are now. And she's won the biggest title of her life. I think is an amazing story.
Mm. Is she in the mix at Roland Garros? Or could she be once the draw is made in just over a week from now?
Oh, I knew this was coming.
Come on.
Yeah. Oh. Despite everything I've just said.
I think, David, I think I'd be very surprised if in 12 months' time I weren't putting her in my French Open mix. I think the game is there. I do. I wonder if sort of belief-wise she still has one or two more steps to go before a Grand Slam title feels achievable. And I do think belief is very crucial for Ons Jabeur. I've seen such development in that department recently. There's also the question mark of whether it's a mix of one in the women's game, whether anybody other than Iga Świątek would be a surprise. Let's TBC on that until the end of Rome, shall we?
All right. Okay. Well, if you wonder what the mix is, what are we talking about? Matt, stick in our show notes a link to our tennis podcast terminology page on the tennis podcast website, which we've written precisely just to let you know what the mix and pack hunters.
Also to remind ourselves what the mix is.
Yeah, and all those things are. It's our glossary.
I think we stitched ourselves up when we set the definition. But anyway.
Yeah, well, we're not stopping now. We've been doing this for 10 years. We're going to carry on. Right. So anyway, well done, Ons Jabeur. Well done, Jessica Pegula, as well, because she had a fantastic tournament. She does it all so quietly, doesn't she? And in a sort of organised, low-key way. But she's had a fantastic tournament and a really good progression, I think, Matt, over the last couple of years. This isn't just out of nowhere, is it?
No, that's right. It's really been a couple of years that she's been building, improving. And I think the fact she's having this season, quarterfinal in Australia, semifinal in Miami, final in Madrid, off the back of what she did last year, where, you know, it was her best season ever. She probably never wanted it to end. There had to be a sort of thought that she might not be able to repeat that again. And she is. She's bettering it. And I just think she's underrated precisely because of kind of her demeanor and how, and I mean this in the nicest way possible, how unspectacular she is. You know, we love Ons Jabeur for, as I said, hitting drop shots behind her back and doing these sort of wizardry things on the court. But Jessica Pegula is kind of fascinating for a different way, because she manages to stay so calm and composed and doesn't get flustered by things and really turns that into her strength. I heard Laura Robson in the commentary box on one of her matches this week talk about how she's like that off court as well. And it's kind of her strength in life, I think, really. And, you know, she dealt with a rain delay, for example, really well. I think when she played Andreescu, she just took it in her stride, came back and just returned to hitting big ground strokes from the baseline, because that's what she does. So I think she's really impressive. And I thought her tweets after the match, where she was she posted that champagne she'd been given, you could see her reflection in it, and she said kind of, I think, what summed up tennis really for a lot of players. You know, she's playing again in 2 days in a different city, in a different tournament, and she's got to move on from this moment, but she's kind of trying to enjoy it while it lasts, kind of thing. And I'm pleased, because I've heard a lot of players talk about how they don't enjoy the moment. And okay, she didn't win the title, but I think she recognises that it was still a big week for her. And yeah, she's great.
She's great. As you say, she moves on to Rome. If she wins the title there, she'll win €332,000, which is €504,000 less than the men's champion will win. So it's less than half of the same tournament for the same category of event. Just have a think about that. It's just absolutely outrageous. And again, it's time for more of an outrage to be heard, I think, about all this. But anyway, that's
we should all be absolutely up in arms about that. Men, women, it cannot continue. It is unacceptable. I mean, the tournament organisers should feel so much shame.
I mean, they're selling tickets.
They should be being asked about it.
For the tournament. They're not selling tickets for the men's event and the women's event. Or, you know, they're hosting this tournament on their grounds. Same number of matches to win the title. And one gender is getting more than double what the other one's getting.
What message does that send? If your daughter asked you about that, why do they do that? What on earth would you say?
I don't know. I'm scared to tell her.
Because unfortunately, you are growing up in a world where women are valued less than men, where things associated with women, things traditionally feminine, are valued less than men. That is the answer. And if you're listening to this and you think, yep, that's the world I want to live in, then, well, you probably don't enjoy this podcast very much. But fine. But I hope you're listening to this thinking, let's change that as a matter of urgency.
Incredibly, some people do listen to this podcast, even though they appear to hate us. But anyway, what I would say is tennis gives itself a big pat on the back because of the fact that the Grand Slams have equal prize money. And that is brilliant. You know, that is something worth celebrating. Those are the most prestigious events. It's an amazing headline. But this is the week-in, week-out reality. You know, I think Rome might be the worst, but it's also bad at a lot of other tournaments. There's a big battleground here on which to fight, and it doesn't get talked about enough because I think you can hide behind the Grand Slams.
And just to address, again, the market forces issue is not an issue. But anyway, the market forces defence, because it is the one that is most lazily and most frequently flung at a situation like this. This prize money situation will be reflected in other financial arrangements behind the scenes. Women are earning 40% of what the men earn. They've got 40% of what the men are getting to promote the sport, to attract the eyeballs. Those are the market forces that you're referring to. Those are not equal terms. It's you're tying women's hands behind their back and saying, why aren't you winning the egg and spoon race? It's ludicrous. And it's lazy to resort to that. It's not a fair fight. It is 40% of a fair fight.
Why does it need to be a fight anyway? Just hold the tournament and give them the same. For God's sake. It's the tournament.
It's a fight, David. It's a fight.
It shouldn't be a fight. It's bloody ridiculous. Anyway, the tournament's going to happen over the course of this week. Some matches have already taken place. Stan Wawrinka beat Riley Opelka today. That was his first win since 2021 at the Australian Open. So well done, Stan Wawrinka. Denis Shapovalov had a meltdown today. What else is new? But he won his match, so well done to him. Beat Lorenzo Sonego. Matt saw it.
All I'm going to say about this is that Denis Shapovalov has obviously not watched Martina Hingis versus Steffi Graf in the 1999 Roland Garros final, because he does not know that you cannot cross the net to point out a mark. And how he is a professional tennis player and doesn't know that rule is beyond me. But he knows it now.
He does.
He also doesn't seem to know that the official terminology in tennis is shut your fuck up, not shut the fuck up. It's very important that that's...
So, Dennis, go back and watch.
Daniel go back Medvedev. And watch Tsitsipas Medvedev Miami 2018 and go back and watch Graf Hingis Roland Garros 1999. Yeah. That's your homework.
That's right. Okay. Naomi Osaka's withdrawn. Achilles injury she's got, sadly. Let's hope she's better soon. A couple of good matches, though, in the first round, including Emma Raducanu against Bianca Andreescu. And Nadal and Djokovic have been drawn in the same half. Djokovic needs to reach the semifinals to retain the number one ranking. And Medvedev's going to be back in Geneva next week. So that's going to be interesting to see if that actually ends up happening.
I've missed Medvedev on clay. He was a right laugh last year.
Mm. He was.
Yeah. It was in Rome, wasn't it, when he said this surface was for dogs or something.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. Gilles Simon has retired, or is going to retire at the end of the year.
Announced during the Alcaraz-Djokovic match.
Yeah, he took one look at that.
I'm not playing against him.
I'm out of here.
Decided to bury the bad news in the middle of that one. But good career by me. A way better career than I'd have expected he would have had. He's been playing for a long while now. Right, mascots. Let's end on a nice note because our mascot this week is Ted. And Ted is owned by friend of the tennis podcast, Mark Forbes, who is Southampton FC's kit man and has been a great friend to us for many a year. He's now an official friend as well. And Ted is 6 years old. He's a Pomeranian. How do I say this, Catherine? A Pomeranian. Pomeranian Terrier. Who loves chasing tennis balls, loves Southampton FC, obviously, and he also has a small portion of London Pride when he's at the local pub. Very nice.
Don't let Billie Jean hear about that. I used to live below a pair of Pomeranians called Rocky and Elvis, and Elvis mysteriously disappeared.
Oh, my God.
Right, okay. Well, anyway, Ted is wearing a T-shirt that's got a picture of a John McEnroe circa 1981 headband on, and Andre Agassi and Bjorn Borg as well. It's a very nice T-shirt, Ted.
We like it. We like Ted. We like Kitman Forbesy.
Yes. Fellow Premier League Southampton. Just thought I'd get that in there.
Catherine, do you want to come and do our own podcast? Because... not of anyone anymore.
Yeah, let's go back to the good old days.
When we just can suffer together. I've got my own mascot, which is Darwin. Catherine's got Carter. Matt's got Gerald. Poor old Gerald, who left us last week. And we're thinking of Daryl and Liz. Billie Jean is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. Chris Albert Lee and Carl Weingartner are our top blokes and executive producers. And Matt, we have some shout-outs.
We do. We have Diane Martin from Melbourne, but now living in Bangkok.
Oh, hello, Diane.
Hello, Diane. Like Diane Parry.
Who's Diane Parry?
The French tennis player.
Really?
And Roland Garros wildcard recipient.
Yes.
Annually. Mm. If you can name me another tennis Diane, David, I'm all ears, but I think I've done well there.
Okay, well, I've never heard of her, but anyway, I can't think of any others. And
I guarantee she exists. I think she's French.
Okay, I'll believe you. And Diane...
anyway, thank you, Diane.
Marvellous friend. Thank you so much, Matt.
We also have Mariana Erica Manessi, who is in Corfu.
Great name. Oh, imagine living in Corfu.
Oh, yes, please.
It's like sort of living in Honolulu, isn't it?
Being on holiday permanently. Mm. Fantastic.
I assume Mariana is the female version of Mariano of Puerta and Zabaleta fame.
Yeah, Puerta, who was Rafael Nadal's first victim in the French Open final 13 titles ago.
Mm. Yeah, anyway, that's not your name, Mariana. I realise that, but I can't think of a tennis Mariana. So you are a one-off, and we thank you for your support.
We do.
I thought of a Diane, by the way.
Oh, yeah?
Diane Fromholtz, I believe, reached an Australian Open final 1 year. She's sort of 70s era.
It's just showing off, Matt. Next.
How'd you know that?
That's tennis amazing. Relived. And we also have Matt Fribbence from London.
Oh, good
Hello,
old
Matt.
Matt.
We like Matts.
All right, Matt.
Most of the time, and they're not being smug about football, we like Matts.
Who do you support, Matt? Better be somebody lower than Reading and Albion. Anyway, carry on, Matt.
Well, I haven't got much more to say, other than this Matt has actually told a lovely story about his first ever Wimbledon experience, watching Britain beat Egypt in a Davis Cup match on Court 1 in 1996, which he believes was one of the last matches ever played on the old Court 1 at Wimbledon.
Yeah.
David's nodding.
Remember it well. You and me, Matt. We can do our own relived, all about Britain against Egypt from the 90s. Oh, that'd be great. Catherine doesn't seem overly interested. Anyway, very much enjoyed this this edition of the Tennis Podcast. And having you back, Catherine, looking forward to going to Roland Garros in just over a week's time. Can't wait. We've got loads of other shows to record in the meantime. We'll be back on Thursday with our Thursday show, then a Rome review on Monday. And we've got Tennis Relived coming the way of Friends of the Tennis Podcast next week, and we've got a couple of belting shows lined up for you. We'll tell you all about them in our newsletter tomorrow. If you'd like to become a friend, please do. That's what keeps the show on the road. That's what gets us to Roland Garros and to the other Grand Slams that we're travelling to this year. So thank you for all of those of you that are. If you'd like to sign up, the link is in the show notes. Do become a friend. And we'll speak to you on Thursday.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.